All right, welcome back. It's another week. Well, it's kind of a split week. The first 2 days are August, and the remaining three, or however you'd like to count, belong to September. It's the 29th yesterday. Today's the 30th. Tomorrow's the 31st, and then goodbye, August. Another weekend gone as well. And if time goes much faster, I think I'll just sleep through. Why bother getting up? It's amazing. Peter Davenport is on tonight. We're going to do a lot of things to inform and enrich you in terms of bringing information your way. He is, of course, one of the busiest men in America and is doing the work of an awful lot of people to bring to all of us the data that the government, if it was really a government, should be routinely making available to all of its citizens. But that's not how the game is played nowadays, as you folks well know. Are you there, Mr. Davenport?
I am here indeed, Jeff. Can you hear me on my cell phone tonight?
Senator, you've never sounded better.
Good. Interestingly, the quality of my cell phone, people tell me, is much better than the quality of the landline, so we'll give it a try again tonight, as we did back, I think it was the 10th of June,
yeah,
when we did a program together, and I used the cell phone. It seems to work just fine, so we'll give it a try. One minor correction to your introduction. I thank you for the kind words. As always, you're way too kind to me. I don't deserve it, but I'm the second busiest person in this country, standing right behind you, I think. I don't know how I've been able to work two shifts a day for 7 days a week for 16 years, but yeah, it is clear to me that you work harder than I do. I don't know that you ever sleep, do you?
I don't use that word very often.
I wonder whether your listeners and the people who enjoy your magnificent website have any idea how hard you work to put that information there, to make it available to people anywhere in the world who might be interested in paying attention to real news in lieu of the sort of the vacuous pap, I call it, that is force-fed to the American people and elsewhere on this planet by the billion-dollar news, billion-dollar corporations that call themselves the news industry.
Well, thank they're despicable. It's not news. It's product. It's mind control. It's programming. We know what it is, and you folks listening know what it is. You wouldn't be listening to this program. And I'm very grateful, Peter, for the kind words. As with you, we do this because it is a great honor to have earned the trust of a lot of people around the world. And that is correct. You are known in every country of the world. I assume I am as well. There are people out there all over this planet, no matter what culture they come from, no matter what language they speak, as long as they're able to understand English, and who are seeking, I don't use the word truth anymore because it's really been corrupted, but those who are seeking reality. And that's what we're trying to bring them. Reality. The reality of it is, in terms of Peter's work, that this planet is being and has been visited continually by off-planet intelligent life forms and continues to be. The reality is, as I see it, is that the planet we live upon now is in severe trouble. I won't go down that road right now. You've been down there with me many times. I'm not particularly optimistic by any measure that it can be redeemed under its current paradigm of abject evil, but we will continue to try as long as we are able. And again, I do think you would have made a magnificent senator, but you're far too smart to dive into that milieu in Washington, because those people are so bought and sold and blackmailed and paid for, it's an obscenity in most cases. And that's like 95%, I'm afraid. The rest of them don't have the guts to stand up and do what's right. They keep voting on these pieces of outrageous, unconstitutional filth that they call bills, and the people vote for them and send them back. I don't know. We'll see what happens in November. It'll be an interesting election, but you can rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, that if any race is within 3 or 4 points, 5 points, the incumbent, or that person, that individual who is desirable in terms of the controllers, will win. Count on it. Unless you've got a 20-point runaway, it's all fixed. ES&S bought Diebold. They own it. They own 95% of the electronic voting machines. We've been through this road before, of course, many times, looking left and looking right and seeing all the corruption, all the fixes, all the propensity for people to do whatever they can to throw elections any way they can. And they do all the time. It's amazing. So do I take national public politics seriously anymore? No, I don't. I do locally. You want to make a difference? Roll up your sleeves and go out into your community and do something, your hometown. But voting for the scumbags in Washington and this Glenn Beck obscenity, I mean, it just goes, it's endless. And unfortunately, most of the sheep just keep their head down and continue chewing. Not all of them, but quite a few. Anyway,
yep.
There's a
well
story.
Well spoken.
Well,
well
thank
spoken.
Thank you.
And we have a guest tonight who I had the opportunity of talking to him on these issues before the program, earlier this afternoon, the late afternoon. And it's interesting how so many people from diverse walks of life around this country have come to the same conclusion as to what's going on.
Right.
But boy, I am delighted to be on for 3 hours tonight, Jeff. There, 1 hour, I usually end up with half a dozen things that I wish I'd said during the 1 hour I had. So we've got a fascinating guest during this first hour with an absolutely stunning report of what happened aboard a Coast Guard cutter out in the mid-Atlantic back in 1973, and I think he's just yearning to tell his story.
Terrific. All right, let's bring him on. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Peter's here. Say hi to Peter.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing, sir?
Good evening, Ron, and thank you very much for coming on. After we have heard you tell your story, Ron, I'm going to tell our audience just to what extent you have gone to get to the truth in this matter. I cannot tell you how delighted I am to have you on with Jeff and me tonight to tell this fascinating story. And I hope that it will help bring other people forward who were party to this dramatic incident that you're going to tell us about tonight.
And first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on your program.
Of course. My pleasure. I'm glad you're here, and I salute you for stepping forward with something that, again, is our birthright, whether it be inside the military or outside the military. But our government, of course, as you well know, Ron, does not think it is our business. It's their business. So we have plenty of time. Do take your time. Let's just kind of walk through it with you, if you would, and tell us what happened.
Okay. Well, I was aboard a Coast Guard cutter from 1970 and a half through about 1973. And we would go out into the middle Atlantic Ocean and stand ocean stations for about 30, 40 days. Some of the ocean stations were Bravo, Charlie, and Echo. I do believe this sighting happened at Echo because, and by the way, ocean station Echo is off of the coast of North Atlanta, off of the coast of North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
In the middle Atlantic Ocean.
How far out?
Right in about the middle of the ocean.
So you're out there in a boat that was commissioned in 1936.
Yes, sir.
And you're out there bobbing and weaving with no land in sight, shall we say, just for fun, and not even a seagull in sight, I wouldn't imagine, for 40 days?
Yes, sir.
I have to ask you one other question. I assume you don't get seasick.
Oh, everybody gets seasick.
Oh, my. All right.
That's a misnomer. There was been times where we were out in the middle Atlantic Ocean in the Ocean Station Bravo, which is maybe 200 miles south of Greenland, where actually we went over the area where the Titanic went down, and the seas are very, very rough. 100-knot winds,
100-knot winds?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my. All right, hold on, Ron, right there. We'll pick it up in that little description of yours in just a couple of seconds. We'll be right back. All right, well, that sounds like music perhaps appropriate for the soundtrack of a film showing 100-knot winds. Gee, I'm sorry, Ron. That's a tough one for me to put myself in. You're out there in the middle of nowhere. Obviously, it gets quite cold for 30 or 40 days, and the wind's blowing 100 knots. Do we think the ship is going to blow over? How secure do you feel on that thing?
Not very. It's not always like that, but when you do hit a storm, it's very, very scary. And like I said, I would take seasick pills. Everybody would get sick. It didn't happen all the time. UFO sighting that occurred, happened, I believe, off Ocean Station Echo, which was, I'll set the stage for you. The seas were fairly calm. It was nighttime. I remember being down below. I was a radio man aboard this ship, and they piped over the system down below that there's a UFO. Come up and see it.
Really?
On deck.
Was this clear? This must have been cleared by the captain.
Yes. Oh, of course. But there's a PA system throughout the
I understand.
Ship.
But they invited everyone to come up and see this thing.
Yeah,
how interesting.
Come check this out. And so there was 140 men aboard this ship at any one time, or give or take. And I would imagine pretty much the only ones that didn't get the chance to go out there was probably they were either on duty in the radar room or whatever, CIC. Mm-hmm. Or in the boiler room, or they were sleeping, maybe waiting for their turn. But the other ones, all of us went up on deck. And like I said, when we got out there, it was warm. I remember the seas were calm. And in retrospect to the high seas, there are times where you're out in the middle Atlantic Ocean off of like Ocean Station Echo. The water is like a sheet of glass. There isn't a wave for as far as you can see. Hmm. So it goes from like a sheet of glass to horrendous seas. But at this time, the seas were fairly calm. I remember it being warm. I remember it was, dark, nighttime. And of course, there's a lot of lights aboard our ship, running lights aboard our ship. And we all went up and we were looking at this UFO, our lights in the sky. Being a Coast Guard, we're trained to observe, and we know what an airplane is. We know what things are.
Mm-hmm.
The lights on this thing that we saw were extremely bright. Now, remember, we're back in early 70s.
Cloudy night, Ron, or clear?
Pardon me?
Cloudy or clear?
Oh, no. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was clear.
Okay.
There was no clouds. But this object was, first of all, the lights on it, they would change colors. They were back then, LED lights didn't exist. They were that bright. It definitely was not an airplane. We know what an airplane looks like. I mean, if you look up the sky, you know what an airplane lights look like. These were extremely bright and vivid. We were just watching it. And I remember there was a marine science technician aboard my ship that I was friends with. And he had state-of-the-art camera equipment. I remember it was Olympus, I believe, telephoto lenses and everything. And he could—he had all this fancy equipment. He could put your picture on your T-shirt back then, which was a big thing back then. But the man had a lot of state-of-the-art camera equipment. Well, he was up there with the telephoto lenses taking pictures of this thing. And this UFO, like I said, it was like it was put on a show for us. It would evidently come down because it would get real big. Then it would go straight up. It'd be like a tiny little speck. Then it would come back down again, and it would right angles in the sky. It would go across the sky, come back. Like I said, it was actually like trying to show off or I would imagine this UFO saw us, because if an airplane, if you would understand. If you're in an airplane, you're above the ocean, and you're looking down on a black sea, then there's these bright lights on a ship.
Right.
We're going to stand out.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure this, I'm assuming that this thing could see us. But the lights were, would like, the, they would also like luminance. They were I don't know how to explain it, but...
Let me ask you, Ron, excuse me, please. When you're looking up, how many different lights were there? Were the lights stationary? Were they blinking? Were they moving around at what appeared to be a body of a craft? Or were they just kind of coalesced into one big, bright light?
The lights would go on and off. They were different colors. They would luminant, too, at sometimes. It was a round object when it would come down low. I'm not positive because it was 38 years ago or something like that, but
yeah.
I do believe someone said there was portals or lights inside they could see in.
Oh, really?
I'm not positive that.
So this, okay, so help me out here now. You and I are standing on the deck. I'm on one side. Peter's on the other. Where are we? Port starboard?
I can remember I was on the towards the bow of the ship,
right.
On a flying bridge up above.
Okay. All right, good.
And I'm looking up, I guess, just straight up, I can remember. That's all. I don't know whether it was north, south, east, or west. But
okay, but you're pretty much looking up, and this object is going up and down. As it comes down, are you personally ever able to see the shape of a machine up there? Let's put it that way.
No.
The shape of a craft. Okay.
No, we can only see the shape of the craft by the lights.
Very good. Okay, and the lights, we're going to take a break here again, and then we'll come back for a long segment. The lights were what colors, Ron? Do you remember?
They would be red, green. They're different colors.
And they were stationary in their positions on the object, or were
they
moving?
They would go on and off, and it would come back. Whereas, say, a red one would go off, a blue one would come on.
In its place.
So I guess that's the best way to describe that.
All right, all right. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's obviously a sensational thing to see. Be right back in just a couple minutes as Peter and I continue with Ron. All right, we're back, and we're talking to Ron, who was giving us an amazing description. When this item, Ron, and all the different colors got to its lowest point, its closest point to you, what would you hold in your hand to cover it? How big would the object have been? Would you hold a ping pong ball between thumb and forefinger? Would you hold an orange in your hand? Would you hold a softball? Or was it bigger than that? How big was it in the sky, approximately?
I would guess that it was like maybe came down maybe the size of a quarter or bigger than a quarter that would cover if you held it for a... Didn't come down real close.
Okay, a 25-cent piece at arm's distance would covered most of it.
Well, not at arm piece. I mean, fairly close.
No, I'm talking about if you stretch your arm out.
Oh, you stretch your arm out. I would say a baseball.
All right, there you go. Now, that's pretty doggone big. Peter?
I was just going to say a baseball held at arm's length would be probably about 10 to 15 times the diameter of a full moon. Was it that big, Ron? How big was it relative to a full moon?
Oh, yeah. It was definitely a lot bigger than a full moon.
Oh, boy.
All right,
very large object.
All right, so what are you guys saying?
We're all together. Actually, you know, I'm young at the time. I'm in my early 20s. And we're just like, wow, this is, you know, we're just looking at it, and it's like, I guess we're like in awe, like we're watching fireworks. We're not going, it's a UFO. We're just enjoying this, watching this thing stream across the sky, come down at us. Like I said, it was put on a show, and all the colors and everything. And we're just, you know, just thinking about. I do remember my friend with his camera with his telephoto lenses. He says, "Where do you see these pictures?" Because he's taking them with a telephoto lenses. And I remember wanting to see these pictures. I never got to see them. I'll explain later why. But at the time, I went and did a lot of thinking about it. And I would say that the duration of this sighting was probably about anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour.
That's an enormous spectacle.
Wow. Yeah, it was for quite a long time.
What were the officers? Excuse me, Jeff.
No, Peter. Go ahead,
what
please.
Were the officers saying, Ron? There must have been people running around and calling the captain to the bridge or doing something of activity. What did you see? Were you out on the deck, or did you say you were up on the flying bridge?
I was up. Yeah. Well, that's out on the, that's outside, of course. It's above the bridge, I guess you'd call it. There's a landing area up there. You could climb up there. Actually, that was one of my stations during battle stations. What I remember, the officers were writing down, taking notes of what was going on. I don't remember a lot of people talking about it. I just remember, you know, there may be back and forth. Wow, did you see that? Or wow, that's unreal. Did you see? And that's about all I can remember. And I do remember there was, the communications officer, was fairly close to me. And, I remember, him writing down, what he's seeing.
And this, this object would go across the horizon, so to speak, and then back the other direction, up and down, and was it doing?
It actually did right angles too. I mean, real fast and boom, and go 90 degrees. Like, I mean, that, we knew it wasn't an airplane.
Yeah. Okay. This is sensational.
I mean, it made maneuvers that are impossible for any
right.
craft that we know that could.
Well, it would have turned any human occupants into jello if they were in there, or worse.
I'm curious to know if there were any general quarters called or commanded during this episode. Were people just standing around, or were they talking about it? Were officers instructing men what to do? What was going on the boat at that time?
Okay, there was the only thing I remember was that they did announce bullet one before I was out. I went on board up. I mean, I'm on deck. That, you know, there's come up if you want to see a UFO, come up. It wasn't really general quarters or nothing like that, or an emergency. It was just an invitation to if you wanted to see this. As far as the atmosphere and what was going on, I just remember it was just people. We were all looking at this thing in awe, witnessing it, I guess. I don't remember any emergencies, nothing like that. It was just, we were all watching this thing.
For nearly an hour. Wow. Were the lights flashing, coming off and on during the entire time?
Yeah, they would go on and off, and like I said, they were, I remember different colors.
Wow, that must have been just almost beyond description. You're doing a fine job, but what a scene.
Was the ship maneuvering relative to this? Were you underway, or was it dead in the water at the time?
We were dead in the water, from what I remember.
Wow.
No problem with the electrical systems on board, nothing like that?
No. Okay. Now, another thing I was going to bring up is, I don't remember hearing any sounds coming from this object at all. No jet roar or nothing. But of course, the ship makes its own noises, so it could have it may have drowned out any sounds it was making. But I don't recall hearing any sounds whatsoever.
Now, this would be the toughest question that we always have to ask, but at least I do. Peter's smarter than I am. At night, it's almost impossible to judge distance. You got a softball held at arm's distance, which is about as big as this thing was. What's your best guesstimate? How close did it come to you? How far away was it?
I really don't know.
Good answer. Fair enough.
Did you have optical triangulation devices, rangefinders on the vessel? Do you know, Ron?
Did we have what?
Rangefinders mounted on the decks of the vessel for determining the range to ships, for example, in the distance. Optical devices that triangulate on a distant target.
Not that I can remember. I don't remember anybody using any type of devices to figure out the distance. like I said, it would come down, and then it, within a second later, it was a little tiny little speck, like it went straight up. And it, like I said, now it would go from where I could take a baseball arm's length and cover it, and then a second later, it's a tiny little speck.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, we assumed that it went straight up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The vessel must have had radar on it.
Yes, we did.
Do you know the angle up at which that radar was capable of looking? Usually it's tuned and focused to look for targets on the horizon.
Right, we had
seen
surface
that
radar.
Mm-hmm. Did you have radar that could detect aircraft as well as ships?
Yeah, I'm sure we did, but I wasn't a radar man, and I really didn't get a chance to get up in the radar and understand what they do. But I didn't talk to. I do remember some friends of mine that were radar men,
uh-huh.
I don't remember the blips or what they look like.
Okay,
I wasn't in the radar room.
Stand by a second. Yep. We'll be right back. Okay, and let's get right back to Ron. All right, Ron, 1974, 74.
It was either 70, between 71 and 73, because I can't remember the exact year, but that's the years that it could have been.
All right, so what happened? How did this thing wind up its show for you guys?
Okay, something I do, while you were on break, I do remember us talking, like, we were like wishing that it would come down, and we wanted to, you know, we if it was a, you know, if the UFO, if it's a Billy, whatever, we really wanted it closer. We were, you know, I guess we just were wishing it would land, you know.
You haven't heard that old
expression. Or something. You
haven't heard that.
Didn't happen.
You didn't hear that old expression.
What's that?
Be careful what you wish for.
Oh. Now. The last part was when it finally was gone. Like I said, it would come down, and the last thing it this time when it would come down and it went straight up first or whatever came to a tiny little speck, it was completely gone. There was no lights whatsoever. I do know my friend with the MST. He took dozens and dozens of pictures with his telephoto lenses of this thing. I'm going to take the story on. And at this time, we're all just wow. We saw some light, you know, UFO and. That's about all we were thinking about it, on the ship. And, we were talking about what we all saw, and we know we all saw it because too many of us seen it. And, now we're heading, okay, we've got relieved. Now we're heading back to our home port, which is in Governor's Island, New York, Yankee Pier. And, the ship's heading back to our port. And, I remember we were docking. It was in the afternoon. It was a sunny day. It was warm. And if you understand, anybody who's been out at sea for 40 some days, you had like, you usually had three duty sections, and one would have to stand duty upon arrival or after docking, and the other two are granted liberty. Well, I was going to get liberty that time, and so you would have your stuff ready, and you'd be wanting to go, and you'd get to the airport and go fly home and go see your family. So as we're pulling, I remember as we're coming into Yankee Pier and we're getting ready to dock and more, I remember looking down and you have a station when you're mooring, and I'm looking on the dock, and I noticed these group of men and in black suits and white shirts and ties, sunglasses, and back then the term men in black was not known. But these are who they actually were. These were men in black.
Uh-huh.
And there was a group of them on the dock.
How many?
I would say 10, 15 of them.
Were there cars around them parked?
I don't remember seeing the cars. I just remember seeing there were no cars on the dock. You really can't get them down there.
Okay. All right. Now, these guys are all dressed, I'm going to guess, identically?
Yes. I mean, it was, if you saw the movie Men in Black, that's what they were. That's exactly what they looked like.
All right. Wow.
And I didn't have no idea. Like I said, back in those days, the term Men in Black, I had no idea who they were.
Sure.
I thought maybe they were, I didn't know who they were. I don't know why they were there. I thought maybe they were, you know, friends of the captain to welcome him back or what. I had no idea who they were. Mm-hmm. But I do know there was quite a large group of them. They came aboard first. And then we were told, no, you can't go. No, we weren't being granted liberty, which usually right after we're moored and secured from mooring, we're allowed to go. Well, we're not allowed to go nowhere. And then we're told that we're going to be, questioned. This is when things started getting a little scary. I remember being interrogated in on the below deck, which was our mess deck where we ate. There was like metal tables down there where we'd eat, and there was these men would they interrogated everybody, and they said that you didn't see nothing, and we had to sign affidavits stating that you didn't see anything, that you were that you can, if you go to any news media, and by the way, this was in New York City, if you would go to any news media and tell anybody this story, we recommend they went from warning to threatening to kill you.
Hold on. They went from warnings to threatening to kill you.
Yes.
Can you give me elaborate a little bit more on that, please?
They would start off interrogating you, and we had it. They said that you will not get off the ship until you sign this affidavit.
Was this one-on-one?
One-on-one.
15-on-one? It was what?
One-on-one.
All right. And they go ahead. You would not get off the ship until you sign an affidavit. I want to hear about this threat to kill you.
Okay. Now, if you they wanted to make sure you weren't going to go anywhere, and they actually, I kind of was like laughing it off, like, yeah, right, you know. And they made it clear that we're not joking around. You will be gone, and they'll be able to find you. And I'm getting scared. I'm thinking, you know, you guys are for real, or what are, you know? And like I said, at 20-some years old, I'm probably a lot cockier then, and I don't really take what I'm being told all that much. But now I'm understanding that my life's being threatened. That you better not talk about this to nobody.
And they still had their hats and sunglasses on.
Oh yes.
Too weird.
It was just, you know, sunglasses. Just I remember sitting there and being interrogated and being told you did not see nothing.
This is in a room on the ship. Did you have a look at the other ones to the extent that you could see facial bone structure? Did their faces look identical, similar? Did you notice anything about them? As you remember, it's tough. But
I remember them. They were white men. Fairly, you know, maybe 6 foot tall. And as a matter of fact, from what I remember, a lot of them did look alike. They were not well. You wouldn't see one fat, one skinny. They were all like either thin they're, I guess, in good shape.
There was not a lot of variation.
No, there was not.
Okay. All right. So this interrogation with you and your man in black went on for about how long?
Half hour, 45 minutes.
All right. And go ahead, Peter.
I was just going to ask, was everybody in the crew, Ron, treated the same way? Did everybody go into that room, number one? And question number two is, when an individual went into that room on that ship, were all of these fellows in suits present to interrogate that one crew member? How did the interrogation work?
They all came on board. I remember them coming on board, and they kind of dispersed. And this one would take care of, say, like all the radio men and everybody in operations. And we had to stand there, and like, you know, one by one, you'd be sent over to sit down and talk.
Could the other men? Could the other Ron?
You were in a line.
Ron, could the other men watch and observe and hear the interrogation going on, or were you were taken in a singular fashion?
Right, singular fashion.
Okay, very good.
But when it was all over, I remember talking to my friends, and they went through the same thing that I did.
Mm-hmm. So presumably, every person aboard that vessel was interrogated. Does that include officers, do you know?
I don't remember seeing any officers being interrogated because I was in a group with the operations people.
Mm-hmm. So presumably the officers could have been summoned to the skipper's quarters or some isolated area on the ship.
That's very possible. Another thing I wanted to back up is when we were out at sea, before we came in, I was a radio man. I had a secret clearance. I was cleared for top secret. But I do remember a message that was composed. I guess it was made up by the and signed by the captain, and it was sent secure radio teletype to headquarters, Washington, D.C. So I just wanted to interject that piece of information before we got in. The message was sent, I guess maybe that night or the next day that we after the sighting.
I was going to ask if there had been a message sent from sea. I presume there had to have been if those guys who showed up on the pier were going to be there. They had to have known of the incident. So there must have been a detailed message sent to Washington,
D.C. It was actually a report
about this.
It was a report of the sighting. Me being in the radio room, I remember it being sent by secure radio teletype to headquarters, Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. So was it encrypted before it was given to the Radio Shack for transmission?
No. The message is made, the report's made, it's sent by a encrypted radio teletype.
I see. So you just typed in the clear text.
Right, and it jumbles
the teletype.
It scrambles it.
It scrambled, and then it was transmitted in scrambled form.
Yeah, in other words, whoever's receiving it has the same. You have a book, and you have a code, and
sure.
there's challenges to go back and forth, and then both machines have to sync before the message will go through. And it's actually, I remember, it was a hard thing to do to get them things to sync sometimes. But you had to have them sync, and then you would send the regular message, only it was sent encrypted. And it was jumbled.
Yep.
So
and
nobody could intercept the message.
Was it sent by high-frequency radio then? Do you remember the frequencies that you used?
No, for radio teletype, I forget what frequencies they were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, that's fascinating.
But I do remember the being interrogated, and I thought, come on, it's a joke. We just saw a UFO. What's the big deal? That's my thinking. When I'm going down, and then when I seen how serious these people were, and how intimidating they became very quickly. It was scary.
All right. Hold on right there, if you would, Ron. We have to take our top of the hour break. I've got some more questions for you. You've done a marvelous job describing this. Hang on. Figure, Peter, 15 men in black, crew of 140-some, divided up, and they each had their quota to take care of. And
yep.
If they each did 10 men, and that would be... 45 minutes, 10 hours of work or something for the group. Okay, we'll be back with more. It's an amazing story, for sure. I wonder how many more are like this. We've had, over the years, other reports, aircraft carriers and on and on. Back with more, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few. It's great music. Peter Davenport and I, and all of you good people, and our special guest, Ron. Ron, if I may, I'd like to go back and ask a couple questions about these men in black. Peter, do you have something first, please?
No, I don't. I think I've pretty well posed my question, Jeff. Ron has done a great job. The only thing I was going to ask is whether the object they were looking at was on both sides of the vessel. Did it circle the vessel, Ron, or was it pretty much on the port or starboard side throughout most of the incident?
I believe what I remember is being towards the bow of the ship and maybe looking up and maybe forward. So I would say, and of course it was above our ship.
Yeah.
But I would say more towards the bow of it. Another thing I was going to tell you is understand... being out at sea for 40-some days, or you saw this UFO, we didn't think that big of a deal, that it was that big of a secret. And after being out at sea this many days, all you want to do is get home to your girlfriend and your family and get on an airplane and fly home. But like I said, we were told you will not get off the ship until you sign this affidavit and, you know, and all this other stuff, until we get through this interrogation. The following, I remember it was like the, I guess when I got back, I had found out that my friend's MST with the camera, every bit of his camera equipment was confiscated. Every stitch of it, everything he owned, and he owned thousands of dollars. I know it was thousands of dollars worth of equipment. They took everything. Of course, they didn't give him a penny for it. They took everything. Anything that he had, I mean, he had things to make the pictures, developers and stuff like that. They took everything that he had. I remember him telling me, and I said, well, did they pay you for it? No, he did. They just took it from him.
Wow.
And that was something I did want to interject, something he went through, probably a little worse than what I went through, but I don't think I'd enjoy having all my stuff taken away from me and not being paid for.
No, it's absurd.
Yeah.
All right.
Was this Marine Science Technician, the MST you alluded to,
right?
Was he a member of the Coast Guard? Was he enlisted or an officer? Or was he somebody placed aboard your vessel to take reading samples while you're at sea?
He was in the Coast Guard. He was enlisted. That was his rate. Like, I was a radio man. He was a MST, Marine Science.
I see.
When we were out at sea, we would have a BT winch. We would drop this cable. It would go down maybe 1 or 2 miles, and they'd have this cylinder that might be 3 feet long and maybe about 6 inches diameter, and it would drop. We would drop it from off the cable, a BT winch, drop it straight down two or three miles till it hit the bottom of the ocean floor, and then we'd pull back sediments, and they would check, sediments from the bottom of the ocean. But that's what marine technicians did.
Yeah. Actually, all Navy ships do that at the same time around the world from their respective ships. It's called, BTR, a Bathy thermograph, something or other. I've actually pulled the pins on those to send the lead weight out and watch the wire trail down into the water.
Right.
Yep, that's what presumably one of the responsibilities he had to do that, to measure temperature and salinity at that location. So,
And another purpose of standing in Ocean Station, while you're at an ocean station, you have this quadrant that you're in, and you patrol that. There's the purposes of you, the Coast Guard being out there is, for number one, of course, if a ship is going down in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, at least there's a ship fairly close that could possibly save you, rather than being at shore and having to come out in the ocean to get you. Plus, we did do a lot of weather observations. Me being a radio man, I would send, we had a copy of Morse code, I think I copied like 35 words a minute. But we would back up each other, and we would have to send messages, weather observations, were groups of five numbers, I remember. And that was another part of our job. And, of course, the samples from the bottom of the ocean was another purpose of why we were out there.
Did the affidavit have a time limit on it?
No, I could just remember it looking like a government document. I do remember the man saying, you will not get off the ship until you sign this. Because I was a little bit cocky. I wasn't going to sign it. I said, I'm not signing this. All I saw was just the UFO. I'm not signing nothing. I remember him saying that if you go to the, any news media that, I guess you'll be prosecuted. We got proof that you signed it saying you didn't see nothing. In other words, they would discredit you immediately if you tried to go to the news media.
All right, and how did the threats of death again come
on? I was maybe the reason why I got threatened, I guess, because I wasn't taking them seriously. I didn't know who they were. I thought, you know, what are you doing here? You're not military. What are you doing? I'm thinking, well, you know, why do I got to sign this? And so I was kind of like not being so cooperative and just signing it and saying, okay, I didn't see nothing. I was questioning, and I was I guess giving them a little bit of a hard time, and they were just getting a little bit, I guess after a while they got frustrated with me, and they said, look, if you don't sign this, he said, you will be gone, and there'll be no trace of you. Nobody will ever find you. And that kind of a rhetoric.
Okay. All right. Now, let's, to the best of your ability, go back, and you were interviewed, you were tormented by one of these guys, okay, in a room. What did that man's facial gestures look like? How did he carry himself?
He carried himself like a robot.
All right.
He sat there rigidly. He sat there with a firm look on his face. Just the questions were like given to me like he was an android.
Mechanically, no emotion. He didn't say, "Now, come on, Ron, let's get serious here." That's what I'm trying to get at. So the demeanor of the interview was very mechanical and robot-like or android-like. Did at any time his voice show any what we would call emotional changes in it?
No. He was like, he had total control. That's the demeanor I got from him.
Okay. Now, that at some point had to enter your consciousness and set off some alarm bells. This is pretty weird.
That's
on your ship.
Scared.
Yeah. Okay. All right. When you looked at his face, did it appear that he, this is a long time ago, I'm asking a lot here, did the face appear to be odd in any way? They're wearing these big black horn-rim type glasses, I guess.
They weren't real big. They were dark black sunglasses. I couldn't see his eyes. They were blacked out sunglasses.
All right.
They weren't real big. They were, I guess just a regular pair of sunglasses, not real big, not stylish.
Okay.
Just black rimmed.
Got it. Okay.
And they were the lenses were blacked out. You could not see his eyes.
Okay. Did he appear to have? Do you remember when you looked at his skin? Did anything stick out about that? Did you see 5 days stubble, or his hair? Did it look to be cut normally? He didn't have a hat on, I don't assume. What was his hairstyle like? You couldn't tell because of the hat.
His hair was dark. As a matter of fact, I think all of them had dark hair, groomed haircuts. Like they just had a haircut, fairly short, just a man's haircut where it was just cut, tailored look to him. The suit was pressed. The white shirt was with the black tie. I remember vividly. And incidentally, by the way, you commented 38 years ago. I'd like to say something. My father died when I was 5 years old. I just had a birthday yesterday, Sunday, and I'm 59 now. And there's
Happy
things
birthday.
I remember vividly of my father, and he died when I was five.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess just to say, my memory,
is
maybe better than most.
Yeah. Did you notice anything about his hands? Did you see a wristwatch? Do you remember seeing a ring? Did you see his fingernails look odd in any way? Do you remember any of that?
I can't say that I do.
Okay, that's all right. I'm just fishing around here. The hats were all the same on all the people, right?
Right.
Okay. This is weird. I mean, now, let's fast forward. When you eventually saw the movie Men in Black, what was your reaction to that?
I said, my God, those are the guys that looked like the ones that came aboard our ship.
When you were interrogated or interviewed or when you were sitting with this guy, how many of these fellows were there present when you were talking with them?
Just one.
It's just
like
one.
I remember there was a group. I might have said 20. There may have been more than that, but I do know there was a large group of them, and they did all look alike. They were all just looked the same, about the same height, about the same body build, the same suits.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everybody had the same suit on, the same hat, the same glasses, the same. They were dressed exactly alike. When they came aboard the ship, they just dispersed into different areas of the ship, and I was only interrogated by one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My question is, though, was there an officer from your crew, an officer from your boat, present during that interview, or
no.
Was it just you and that individual?
Just me and the individual.
Hmm.
And
that's kind of what made me, I was offended where, where's our captain, we really liked him.
Hold on, Ron, if you would, please. We have to pause again.
Okay.
Come right back with more after this. Okay, welcome back. And Mark, go right ahead if you remember where you were. I think Peter was asking about first officers present. No, just you and the guy. And you couldn't see through his glasses. That's not a lot of fun when you're trying to talk to somebody. And you were close to him, what, 3-4 feet away?
Yes, and come to think of it, they never said who they were. Something just went through my mind. Because I'm thinking to myself, because at this point now I'm being intimidated. I'm a little bit scared. I'm starting to put one and one together. I'm thinking maybe that's the Secret Service or who are these guys?
What do you think they were now?
Pardon me?
What do you think they were now? What's your best guess? Were these ETs? Possibly? They don't sound like government men. They sound like something else.
I don't know. I could explain what they did and that, but I thought perhaps they were government to cover this up.
Yeah, well, back then, but I mean, what do you think now? Would you rule anything out now?
No, I would still think that they were just trying to cover this up.
Yeah, that's clear, but I mean, when you get so much uniformity and so much rigidity, and dressed like that, it's weird. All right, it's weird. It could have been Coast Guardsmen come on and set you down and talk to you. That's one thing. This is weird. Back then, it's weird.
Do you remember, Ron, how long that secrecy oath would be in force? Did they tell you?
The people interrogating us?
Yeah, the affidaft.
Yeah, you had to sign a document. Just a second, please. You had to sign a document. But do you remember how long that document, that pledge, that secrecy oath was going to be in force?
I thought forever.
Mm-hmm. They didn't tell you that
no,
it expired.
No, they did not tell us. They just warned us, and no, they did not say there's a timeline or nothing. No.
So until Peter formally and officially released you from that binding affidavit, you were still under stricture, right? That was a little joke there, see?
I'm still, I guess, still in that.
All right. So what prompted you to come forward? What decided this issue for you?
I guess at this point in my life, I'm not afraid anymore. And I must say I was pretty scared that they would do something to me or find me and now if they do, I'm 59 years old. I'm not afraid anymore. And I just hope that some other people that saw this, and there was, I would say, probably estimate maybe 100 or 80 other fellow shipmates and officers witnessed the same thing. I just hope they'll come forward.
Well, yeah. It'd be nice. Great job. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's one of the things, and I've got a train going by here. I don't know if you can hear it in the background, but one of the things that I would like to have happen is other members of your crew come forward so we can get their stories. So, again, I'd like you to give the name of the vessel, where you were based, Ron, so if any of our listeners, and probably millions of people around the world are listening to us, if any of them had family members or had spouses who worked aboard, I think you called it the Spencer, a Coast Guard cutter out of Governor's Island in the early 1970s, and they remember this incident, we would like to have them come forward. We'd like them to, as you have done, Ron, so nicely, is submit written reports of what people remember. That would be very important.
Yeah, it was the Coast Guard cutter Spencer. It was called the WEC, WHEC, which stands for Weather High Endurance Cutter 36. The 36 is because it was commissioned in 1936. It was decommissioned in about 1974. There is a new Coast Guard cutter. It's a smaller, I think it's a 270-foot. This was a 327-foot ship, by the way. Incidentally, if you want to Google it, it supposedly sunk more U-boats off Atlantic, Eastern Atlantic coast than any other ship owned by the United States during World War II. It had depth charges on the back of it. I would hope that, like I said, it was the older Coast Guard cutter Spencer that was decommissioned in 1974. The time that this happened, I'm guessing between 71 and 73, because I was I got set, and the by the way, base is Governor's Island, New York, which was a Coast Guard base, which is now shut down, from what I understand. And our it was Yankee Pier is where we were docked. I guess that's enough information for anyone to, if they know someone who was aboard the ship, that was aboard the ship that did, when this sighting happened, that maybe they can get in touch with you. Or I've actually put my name on a blog where for Coast Guard, and hoping someone will contact me.
Yeah. Very good. So there is a website for Coast Guard, and you put up a note there. Oh, good.
It's called Fred's Place, and it's for all kind of Coast Guard stuff, whether you want to on a Coast Guard cutter or a buoy tender or whatever.
By all means, let Peter know what happens.
Yep.
Very good.
Boy, that's a fascinating story, and you tell it very well, Ron. I cannot tell you how thankful I am to you, how grateful I am, and how grateful the American people are to you, not only for your service aboard that vessel in standing ready to save lives at sea, but for your having come forward to share with the American people that experience so they may know what is really going on as opposed to what a few government bureaucrats want them to know.
Yeah, I just thought, okay, maybe in a closing comment, prior to this ever happening, I was probably believing, you know, you believe what you're told, and let me tell you that the government covers up a lot, and don't believe everything you're told by the government, because probably 10% of it's true.
Very good. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ron. Good night.
All right, we'll be right back with more after this. Okay, welcome back. There was a story in the Chicago Tribune I sent to Peter a few days ago, and it came out on August 24th, written by our old friend John Hilkovich, now called a Tribune reporter, otherwise known as the transportation editor or something like that, back in the old, good old days. It's entitled, "The Truth is Out There, But Not Everywhere. Colbert Report Interview Launches Renewed O'Hare UFO Hype." Now, to give Hilkovich the benefit of the doubt, often it's city editors and others will write the headlines for stories that may not be his hype word in there. Somebody may have put it in there. I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. Now, for those of you with long memories, you'll remember that the amazing O'Hare Airport daylight UFO sighting was first broken as a story by Peter Davenport, right on this program. And Peter, because he is a consummate professional and a true journalist, tried to get this story out, at least to the media in the Chicago area immediately, and contacted the Chicago Trib, trying to get a hold of somebody that would cover this story. Tell us a little bit more, and I want to, the punchline is coming up in a few minutes, because this was really an amazing story. Broad daylight sighting of a disc hovering right over one of the passenger terminals at O'Hare International Airport, and that disc briefly took off and went straight up through the cloud cover, which was rather low, and left a perfect round hole through which a blue sky could be seen far above. Tell us a little bit more about that, Peter.
Yeah, you've described it very accurately, very well, Jeff, indeed. And you're right, this story broke on the Jeff Rentz radio program, and I think I can pinpoint the date. I believe it was November 14th of 2006, because this incident occurred, I think I have the year correct, on election night, November November 7th, if I remember, 2006.
It. Right on, as always.
You and I talked about it. I think I called you the day of the event or the day after, the day I got the report.
Mm-hmm.
And the report had been circulating out there. It created quite a stir in the UFO community, UFO investigators. But it really didn't get picked up by the press. And probably in November sometime, I started late November trying to get members of the press interested in this. And it was like trying to beat a dead mule back to its feet with a bullwhip. You couldn't do it. Well, finally, about the second week of December, I called the Chicago Tribune to ask why they were not covering this story, because by that time, we had gotten some very good data from people who had actually had eyesight of this object over gate Charlie 17, C-17. I've actually stood at that gate, Jeff. I went through Chicago one time and went out to gate C-17 to see what it all looked like. And gave the Chicago Tribune some data that I thought they could use to start an investigation, which they had not yet done 6 weeks after the incident. Well, I was on my way to Shreveport, Louisiana, and I got a call from John Hilkovich after I'd sent some material to him. And he said, well, we have interviewed United Airlines, we've interviewed the FAA, and they all deny that this event had ever occurred. They laughed. Mm-hmm. They mocked me, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hilkovich called me, and I gave him some more data and pledged to send him some raw data that would convince him that this incident had actually occurred. We got some written material, Jeff, from the original witness who had called us that left no doubt in the mind of any reasonable person but what this incident had taken place. And I gave him that information, and he finally caught fire and started interviewing people and putting pressure on the FAA. They finally admitted that they had lied to him. So he became alert to the fact that something had occurred. Well, I can tell you the date that his article hit the press. It was the 1st of January, 2007. His article appeared in the Chicago Tribune, and he was interviewed by Melissa Block, NPR radio that day. He was interviewed by an affiliate television station to the Chicago Tribune in Chicago. And I've seen those interviews. I've listened to the interview on NPR, and at no time during any of those interviews and at no place in his article did he ever allude to the fact that the story had been broken 6 weeks earlier on the Jeff Rentz radio program by me, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. Now, quite a while after his article appeared on the 1st of January, he wrote another article at my request after I'd read him the Riot Act, because this is a classic error by a member of the press, is writing a major article like that and not indicating who his sources are.
Well,
so
even worse, it's a classic ego covering up due attribution to the man who brought the story to him, and this is disgusting. He allowed himself to become the center of the story, never mentioning, not even mentioning you. I mean, he had the limelight. He's working for the Chicago Trib. He had the story. To throw you a tiny bit of recognition is too much for the guy. That's the measure of the man. Sorry, that's not a professional. It doesn't work. Doesn't cut it.
And I have a copy of the interview on NPR of John Hilkovich by Melissa Block, who's one of their anchors. And the interesting thing is, not only does he not mention the National UFO Reporting Center, but Melissa Block says, in one of her questions is, I understand that you've been in contact with some UFO people. She said, don't you think that's awfully strange? As if having a member of the press talking to somebody like me is odd.
You're kidding me. She said that?
No, I will play that interview for you. I have
Please.
A copy. On,
play it on the air. Let's share it with our listeners. That's
we'll do that. We'll do that another time.
Well, that's NPR for you, boy. And if you
Absolutely.
Folks think you're getting the truth and the full story and the totality of reality from NPR, better think again. That's amazing.
Yep.
Well, anyway, so Mr. Hiljkovich continues to let people think that he was the source of the story. That's really what it boils down to. And if I'm wrong,
he's
tried to get him on this program. No luck.
Yeah. Well, the night I got the information, I called Dr. Richard Haynes.
Yeah, hang on a sec, Peter, please. We have to take a break. I hear some music in the background. Be right back, folks.
That sounds
fine. Don't go away, and we shall continue. All right, back to Peter, and talking about the amazing O'Hare Airport sighting. All right, Peter, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was about to say, Jeff, when we broke there a few minutes ago, that the night I received the information about this incident was the night of the incident. Again, Tuesday night, I believe it was election night back in 2006, in November of 2006. I immediately called Dr. Richard Haynes, who is the scientific director, I think his title is, of NARCAP, which specializes in aviation cases in which UFOs, or they choose to call them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. He did a very nice report, which was published about 9 months after this incident, in which they provide all of the details of what happened there. They did an in-depth investigation, and people can see that report on their website, narcap.org, narcap.org, narcap.org. But I was just flabbergasted by the tawdry behavior, the unprofessionalism. And I've actually talked to John Hiljkovich about this, and it was predicated on a conversation he and I had. I called him shortly after his interviews on the 1st of January, 2007, and protested. And he was very sheepish, if you can hear sheepishness over the telephone. He was very meek about this, and he later did write an article in which he admitted that they had received this tip, in fact, more than a tip. We'd given him some hard evidence after his initial refusal to cover the story. But
well, you gave him the guy in the you gave him the name of the guy ferrying the Boeing airliner across the tarmac who saw this thing. He and the other guy, you provided him with everything. You rolled out the red carpet for him.
Yeah, and even after we had given him information, given him the tip, and he had gone to United Airlines and gone to the FAA and perhaps to the Transportation Security Administration, he decided he wasn't going to do an article. So he called me on the 14th of December. Again, we're talking 2006, and it's I assured him of the fact that this incident had in fact occurred, and I implored him to cover it, and he finally did. On the 1st of December, he admitted that this was the biggest story that the Chicago Tribune had ever done in its history with respect to the number of responses that they had received from their readership. It was a remarkable incident, and it remains one of the more dramatic cases that I've covered. Imagine a disc, a metallic-looking disc, spinning probably less than 2,000 feet above ground level, above O'Hare Airport, an area called Class B airspace. Nothing is supposed to be there unless it has a transponder that is transmitting to the tower and has a radio in operation and the aircraft is in touch with the tower. nothing without that equipment is supposed to be in that airspace, and yet this object was just hovering there. And the gentleman you alluded to earlier who was taxiing an aircraft, I think we had him on your program once.
Yep, sure did.
He was a mechanic, very unique guy, very tall. And he was taxiing a 747 when he heard the radio chatter about this incident. And he looked in the direction of the gate, again, gate C-17 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. And he saw the object hovering above the gate, and he saw it disappear into the overcast that was above the airport that day. Very interesting case. People can read reports on our website and for that date. But people still talk, as your program still, you and your program still address that issue appropriately, because it was very, very dramatic. People still allude to that one. Leslie Kane, who was just featured on some television program, I don't know which one it was, I don't watch television, but she addressed that issue during her interview, and the interviewer did not even know about it, Jeff. Even though that that aircraft mechanic had been interviewed in profile. His voice was sealed for the CNN interview back in January of 2007. He hadn't heard word one about it. Obviously, he's not listening to your program nearly enough.
Well, Leslie Kane's book, by the way, very interesting parameters to what's going on with this book. There have been a multitude of really outstanding books written about the UFO phenomena. Jim Marr's book, Jim is a true journalist, is an outstanding book. There are just many, many books. So along comes Leslie and cranks out a book that is basically a compendium of known material that has been released by the Disclosure Project witnesses and others. And all of a sudden, the red carpet is rolled out, doors pop open. She is the hottest ticket for a new eclectic guest on any number of news and information and talk and whatever you want to call them programs. Why? Why this book? Why now? Why Leslie? I'm not saying she doesn't deserve it or didn't do a good job with the book, but you got to think that somewhere, somehow, at least I do, a decision was made that this book gets wide dissemination in the media. Somebody made that call. I believe that, because I know too many other people who have written excellent books who can't get anything anywhere. And all of a sudden, Leslie, and she again has done a fine job with the book, gets so many offers and invitations. I imagine she's having trouble keeping up with all of them.
Yeah. The button-down press, as I'm wont to call it, reminds me of a school of piranha in a South American river, racing from one bit of prey to another.
Feeding on,
feeding on carrion, essentially, but none of them wants any of the others to get something that they don't have. So there's this trendiness, or this follow the leader is a better term, type attitude among members of the U.S. press. And let it be said, there is a vast difference between the electronic media as the purveyors of news and the printed word. I once did an essay on the differences between the two, and they are many and they are profound. For example, if you see a news broadcast on a television news report, try to get that video of that report sometime. It'll cost you $50 or $100 to get it, and it takes a great deal of time to do it. Whereas if you read a newspaper or a news magazine, you have the original right there and you can use it any way you wish.
Right.
A lot of differences between the way the press spread the word 50 years ago and the way it happens today.
Yeah, indeed. Yep.
And the internet is a great help, But one of the things that has happened is it has become grossly commercialized. So to see some important bit of information, you have to first look at a 20 or a 30 or a 60 second advertisement to get to the actual news. So once again, the buck reigns. And I'm not sure this is a good idea for a country that has to have accurate information for its citizens to be well enough informed to vote intelligently. And I don't think that is happening today.
No, no, it's not.
It seems self-evident to me, but yeah. I know there are a lot of people out there who may disagree with me, but things are not going well in this country at all, Jeff. It sometimes occurs to me that our country could have been more well-run, more efficiently run by a group of third graders selected at random from across the country.
Or a computer.
In lieu, or a computer.
Yeah.
A deck of cards. Just draw cards and vote yes or no on the basis of the outcome of that draw.
Well, at least we know we wouldn't have the graft and corruption and degeneracy that is drowning what's left of a government here. That, by the way, you out there probably saw some of you. I guess it was Brian Roberts interviewing the alleged president, and how cleverly he handled the birth certificate issue. And he said something like, well, what am I supposed to do? Plaster it to my forehead and walk around with it? And then he just said, facts are facts. I don't know what this is all. He didn't say, I was born here. Facts are facts. He just said, facts are facts. What facts, Mr. President?
The facts speak for themselves.
He said nothing in that interview. Nothing.
Yep.
10%.
I'm afraid, Mr. Excuse me. Go ahead, Jim.
No. I was just going to say 10% substance, so to speak, and 90% noise. That's all it was.
Yep. I think Mr. Obama is a master of the vacuous platitude.
Yeah.
He can say things leaving a hanging implication without actually having said anything at all. And I guess that's the way the presidency has gone. That's the way political leadership has gone in this country.
Right.
You try to say as little as you can to avoid offending anybody and losing votes. But
I'm not sure he's even interested. It is. And I'm not sure he's even interested in votes. He's a one-termer. That's it. He's out. He put in to do a job. Done it. He's absorbed most of the disfavor of the American public, and he will be on his way in 2012 or 2013.
Yeah, I guess. It certainly looks that way, and events across this country certainly support your statement.
Has anyone heard him say one time anything about a second term? I never have. Never. Nothing.
Yeah.
All right, hang on. We have to take a break. We'll come right back. Peter Davenport and I. Tonight, Peter's website is UFOCenter.com. Again, I challenge all you educators to put in a UFO unit in your class, be it high school, junior high school, or college. And you'll see what a popular class is all about. Back in a few. All right, welcome back. Jeff Runtz and Peter Davenport, hour number three. Glad you're along tonight. We had a really remarkable report earlier tonight. Hope you got a chance to hear it from Ron, a U.S. Coast Guardsman, who in 1971 or 2 or 3 was witness to something very, very unusual. That Men in Black thing was also quite interesting. So thank you for arranging that. What did you want to get into this hour? I just came across something that we might put on the table as well.
Good. Let's go to it in a minute, but I had a comment.
Sure.
Your comment about our guest reminded me that there was something I wanted to say. Our listeners may not know, but his original report is available on our website, UFOCenter.com. You may have mentioned that earlier in the program, but he submitted a very nice report that can be accessed on our website for the 22nd of May, 1973. In which he describes in detail what happened during that event. And Boy, he was a wonderful witness, wasn't he, Jeff?
They don't get any better. Yeah, he was superb.
And the thing I was going to comment on when he was on the program was, you have to wonder, and you alluded to this, you have to wonder how many similar cases there are out there. This obviously cannot be the only such case. If they have 10 or 15 or 20 people dressed in black suits and black ties and black sunglasses who go around interviewing people to shut them up, this tells me that there have been incidents like this prior to May of 1973 or whenever it occurred, because they had to have trained those people, had to have had them on the standby, ready to go. It suggests to me that just as we have special units inside the military for handling, for example, broken arrow cases, cases in which nuclear weapons are lost, we, I suspect, also have units that are specially trained to handle UFO-related situations, as mm-hmm. this one apparently was.
Sure. Yeah.
But if people want to read his report, our website was refreshed by our trustworthy webmaster, and they can read our guest's report on at ufocenter.com on our website.
Very good. All right. This is a little bit of a change of pace. We'll get back to UFO subject matter in a few minutes, but this is important. The Department of Justice, well, you almost gag when that expression comes to mind anymore, has put out a new booklet. It's a publication. It's called Public Intelligence, which is it's almost an oxymoron. A recent Department of Justice guide for investigators, as in law enforcement, as in cops, as in undercover agents, as in whatever. A recent Department of Justice guide for investigators of criminal and extremist groups lists constitutionalists and survivalists alongside organizations like Al-Qaeda and the Aryan Brotherhood. So if you believe in the Constitution, or you're putting food away and you want to survive, whatever it is, you're in this book. The 120-page law enforcement sensitive, that's a quote, law enforcement sensitive guide to investigating terrorism and criminal extremism, terms and concepts, describes itself as a glossary designed primarily as a tool for criminal justice professionals to enhance their understanding of words relating to extremist terminology, phrases, activities, symbols, organizations, and selected names that they may encounter while conducting criminal investigations or prosecutions of members of extremist organizations. This is really dangerous stuff, folks. Let me go on. Constitutionalist. I would describe myself as a constitutionalist. I think all good Americans would. Defined by, except for the anarchists and the communists and others. Constitutionalist, defined by Random House's 2010 dictionary as an adherent or advocate of constitutionalism or of an existing constitution, is described in the report from the Department of Justice as a generic term for members of the Patriot Movement. A generic term for members of the Patriot Movement. Survivalists are described in the document as fearing a, quote, coming collapse of civilization, end quote, and are trying to prepare themselves for this collapse. Such individuals are said to have, quote, typically stockpiled food, water, and weapons, especially the latter, and instructed themselves on topics ranging from first aid to childbirth to edible plants. How seditious can it get, Peter? The guide defines the term New World Order as being, quote, used by conspiracy theorists to refer to global conspiracy designed to implement worldwide socialism. End quote. Well, it is. The Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, and the Council on Foreign Relations are described as organizations, quote, targeted by right-wing extremists for conspiring to dominate the world. Well, the guide also defines one world government as, quote, the concept that there will be ultimately a single government body that will control the world, end quote, adding that, quote, some right-wing extremists fear this occurring, believing that white people will be in the minority, with Jewish people ultimately controlling the world. While the document's introduction does state that, quote, the fact that an entry appears in this publication does not imply a connection to illegal activity. Oh, no? I beg to differ. And it goes on to give a list of extremist, get this, Peter, extremist terminology. Now, these are some of the terms in this Department of Justice book. Remember, this is for law enforcement and investigators, undercover and otherwise. Now, here are some examples of extremist terminology. Black helicopters. Bilderbergers, and they're defined. Collection of information. Concentration camps. Constitutionalists. Council on Foreign Relations. Executive orders. Globalization. Illuminati. Information warfare. Jackbooted thug. New World Order. One World Government, Open Source Information or Intelligence, Patriot Movement, Patriots for Profit, Pirate Radio, A Sovereign Citizen, Survivalists, Tax Protest Movement, Trilateral Commission. There are more. In other words, these are examples of, quote, extremist, end quote, terminology. So if you're out there investigating somebody and they happen to use any of these terms, you've got good cause to be suspicious, at the very least, if you're a law enforcement officer. You guys get exactly where this is all going, and it's not going to be good. It's not good now. But it's everywhere you look, it gets worse. This is nuts. Whatever happened to the First Amendment? I mean, let's suppose that the New World Order was completely idiotic and unrealistic. Of course, it isn't. But don't you have a right to talk about it without being targeted as being an extremist on a par with the alleged Al-Qaeda? I mean, this is all. It's too much. It's too much. That's enough. I'm going to put the story up. You guys can read it and pass it around. But this is what your government, your Department of Justice, is putting out to define most of us who care about this country. We are constitutionalists.
Is there a date on that document that you can see, Jeff?
No, not. I cannot see it. It is. I've got the cover of it.
I think I've heard of this document before. It's been discussed for, not very long, but over recent weeks.
Yeah, it's been around a bit, and I haven't got a copy of it. To see the full list below, please visit the U.S. Department of Justice and Terrorism and Criminal Extremism terms from the years 2005 to 2009. Okay? So, indeed, you're correct. It has been around, but it is still makes for very interesting conversation, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Okay, back in a minute. Okay, let's get back to business here. There is I'm going to put this up, there's a PDF download of this 120-page book, which again is put together by the Bureau of Justice Assistance, U.S. Department of Justice. It has the official seal on it, and if you scroll down the PDF a little bit, let me get this other piece. It's 2005 to 2009, inclusive. This project was supported by grant number 2007 NC-BX, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the Office of Justice Programs, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and the Office for Victims of Crime. Points of view or opinions in this document are those of the author and do not represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. So there's their plausible denial. At any rate, it was put together by a grant and in cooperation with this Bureau of Justice Assistance and the U.S. DOJ.
I wonder how long it's going to be, Jeff, before they start declaring UFO investigators and radio talk show hosts as potential threats to the stability of the United States. It won't be long, I anticipate.
Well, that's a given. You're right.
This document takes me back to the Soviet Union, where I used to work 30 years ago as a translator. I spent a very interesting day on a park bench in the city of Rostov on the Don River with a gentleman who had been a chauffeur for a supervisor of a collection of factories in the old Soviet Union. And this chauffeur, while he was driving his boss, one day turned his head and looked back over the front seat and referred to his boss's boss in some pejorative fashion that placed the gentleman in the back seat looking forward at this at his chauffeur in a very difficult position, because people were set up in the Soviet Union to test their loyalty, and people were supposed to turn their fellow citizens in to the Communist Party, to the authorities, if they even thought that they were a threat to the communist system.
Right.
Well, because of this pejorative statement the chauffeur had made to his boss in the back seat, it cost him 8.5 years of his freedom. He was charged with political crimes, and he was sent out to the gold mines in the eastern part of the Soviet Union near Magadan, and he said it was the most horrific conditions he's ever even heard of. They used to take groups of 15 or 20 political prisoners out to the mine sites, summer and winter alike, it didn't matter. During the winter, he said, the only sign that you could tell that there was a gold mine there was by the steam that was coming out of the mine shaft in the ground and the hummocks of ore that were buried under thick snow. He said 15 or 20 people would crawl into that hole. They would be left enough provisions for barely for 1 month, and they were given a quota of ore that they had to drag out of the ground. And he said if they did not fulfill their assigned quota in that first 30-day period, they were left there with an even bigger quota for the second month. And he said invariably the work crew during the second month was smaller than the work crew had been during the first month because people perished out there. And the one thing he told me is that they never let protein go unused. If somebody died, they engaged in cannibalism in those mines. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're headed as a nation if this type of nonsense is allowed to proliferate in Washington, D.C., and it is. That seems to be the general tenor of our government at this stage in our history, and we have to change it. So God forbid what they would do with somebody who believes in UFOs and owns a missile site. Boy, I'm a survivalist and a threat to the regime.
I don't know.
Maybe we'll have adjacent cells.
Yeah, well, that's that old thing. I wonder if we'll be in the same camp. Most Americans, of course, are already in a camp, so to speak. They're in debt. They're barely hanging on. A lot of them aren't hanging on. How much more do you have to do to people before they essentially do live in concentration camps? Why pay to try to house them all when they're already under your thumb? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, this government frightens me because they now have the authority to do just about anything they want, and very few people are speaking out. People forget that we are a republic more than we are a democracy, a republic that consists of 50 independent states which decide for themselves what goes on within their state borders, within a broad latitude as defined by the U.S. Constitution. But we are not a system in which the federal government should be authorized to dictate to all of the states how they must conduct their affairs. And some states are beginning to get their backs up, and I'm delighted to see that, pointing out to the federal government that it does not have the authority to impose a mandatory health care plan on all Americans.
Well, that's the end of the line. If the states don't stand up, that's pretty much it. I agree.
Yeah.
Hold on. Back in just a minute with Peter Davenport. His website, of course, is ufocenter.com. And we don't care how long ago tonight's eyewitness case in point happened in 1971 to 73. We don't care how long ago something happened. If it's really an interesting report, please, by all means, let Peter know. UFOCenter.com is an online report form right there, and we shall continue. Okay, and let's get back to Peter and see what else is on the agenda tonight. What else have you for us?
Well, a couple comments before we move on to other subjects. I meant to mention this earlier, Jeff, when we had Ron on during the first hour and a half.
Yeah.
You may recall that he shared with our listeners the fact that his cutter, the Spencer, was based at, I think he said, Pier Yankee on Governor's Island in New York City. This is only a stone's throw from Wall Street in New York City. It's Governor's Island is just south and a bit east of the tip of Manhattan, and I was going to make a comment when he was talking about that. What he probably doesn't know, I'll send him a note to this effect after the program. There was a very dramatic UFO sighting that occurred in that vicinity. I can tell you the time. It was 10:08 p.m. on a Friday night, the 15th of September, 1995. We know that because some of the passengers who were aboard the Staten Island ferry that was just departing Manhattan saw the craft rise out of the water between the ferry boat and Governor's Island off to the east of it.
Wow.
Very, very dramatic case. And I actually have a videotape that was prepared by people in New York City who were personal witness to this thing who found other witnesses. But the other point I wanted to make is that I posted an announcement to this program to our website last week. I think it was probably Wednesday or Thursday of last week. And combining ufology with security issues and government subterfuge and so on, I suspect tonight we have people listening to this program who tuned in to accumulate intelligence on behalf of the U.S. government. That's the way it works today.
Yep.
And we'll never know about them.
No.
But they are probably preparing reports as we speak,
mm-hmm.
making detailed records of what you and I say and what our guest had to say earlier in the program. And this is not the proper role for the U.S. government, in my opinion. Many people criticize me for not having made the National UFO Reporting Center a 501c3 federal nonprofit organization. They say, you could raise money, Peter, if you were a 501c3. The problem with that is if you are a 501c3 federal IRS nonprofit organization, you may not endorse candidates, and you are forbidden from talking about political issues, as you and I frequently have done over the last 11 or maybe now almost 12 years. And ultimately, ufology becomes very political because the U.S. government is, I am I believe firmly, is lying to the American people. You and I both know that. I suspect our listeners are tuned in tonight.
Sure.
Because they're the type of people whose instincts tell them what is going on. Clearly, the U.S. government is lying to the American people about the UFO phenomenon. And that is, I think, made quite evident by the recent release of yet another chunk of documents on UFOs by the government of the United Kingdom. They are saying, at one time, of course, they parroted the very position that the U.S. government takes, namely, all this UFO stuff is nonsense, et cetera, et cetera. But the government of the U.K. certainly had a lot of documents about a subject that doesn't exist. And I'm sure that the U.S. government must have libraries full of UFO sighting reports. Good heavens, if I can collect now almost 70,000 reports with one telephone and one tape recorder and one very dedicated webmaster, imagine what the U.S. government is capable of doing with trillion-dollar budgets, essentially unlimited money, and unlimited surveillance systems, such as radar and the U.S. Navy surveillance system that cuts across the southern tier of the United States. They must be getting countless UFO reports every day, and they're saying nothing about it.
Well,
that scares me.
Sure.
That scares me vastly more than the UFOs do.
Well, how many? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say UFOs seem to be generally pretty innocuous towards us. That cannot be said of the U.S. government, and I only hope that there is not some kind of collusion between these two.
Well, it depends on which group we're talking about, too. Yeah, which group of visitors we're talking about. I think that they vary. There may be some pretty ugly ones who are in cahoots with some of the dark side that is doing so much to ruin this home that we must somehow survive upon. Your points are all very well taken. Sure.
I don't know what has happened to our government.
Well, it's been bought out, compromised, any way you can imagine over time. That's what happened to it. Vote fraud, vote scam, and that's what happened to it. Big business, big money, big corporations. The American-Israeli Political Action Committee, the biggest lobby and most powerful lobby in America, that's what happened to it. Bribery, blackmail, prostitution, pedophilia, drugs, that's what happened to it. It's all right there.
It has certainly decayed from what I remember back in the 50s. I think a lot of Americans are awakening to this.
They are.
Americans who would call themselves patriots.
Constitutionalists.
Yes. And I wonder how many Americans recognize that to have the federal government talking about a national health care system is in direct, unquestioned violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. There's a group of us up here in my neck of the woods who have been getting together to study the Constitution, to study constitutional issues. And it is very straightforward that the Obama health care plan is in clear violation of the U.S. Constitution, and it is not just I who is saying this.
Mm-hmm.
I think some 27 attorneys general from across the United States have joined in a lawsuit essentially saying precisely that. The only thing that concerns me about that is why the other 23 attorneys general have not joined the first 27, because even a cursory reading of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution makes it very clear that things like a Department of Education or a national health care program are illegal under the U.S. Constitution. But the present regime certainly seems to be ignoring those facts.
Right.
And many others have as well. It's not just this administration.
Well,
many have been doing precisely the same.
Agreed. We have to pause here. The other 23 probably want to be governor, senator, or something else, and so they're not rocking the boat and telling the truth. Back in just a minute. Okay, and let's get back to our final segment already tonight with Peter. Okay, we have a couple of other things, but what we all agree upon, and I think that includes everyone listening to the program, with the exception of some who are working for the government, this country is in very grave condition. It is actually far worse than the mainstream media, which controls the minds of most of America, will ever let on. Now, those who are awakening and getting a piece of the action are often becoming so overwhelmed with the anxiety and stress that that results from such an awareness that they kind of drop out isn't the correct expression, but they certainly don't engage it. They try to protect themselves, which is the most base of all human responses to an overwhelming threat, which is what we're facing here. Others will stand forward and do their best. It's tough when the game is so rigged. And it is totally rigged against the Americans of constitutional orientation. It's not a good picture. And that doesn't mean we quit. That means we have to start locally and pull back and quit playing this game. If you talk to anyone and they say Republican or Democrat, you know right away they don't get it. Because it's a continuum. It's essentially the same machine when you get up to a certain level. And that level is at D.C., they play the role, but we really don't have any difference between the two ultimately. They all vote on the same corrupt, unconstitutional bills, from the Patriot Act to the bailout to all the rest of it. There's so many, the MCA, too many to count. There are a couple good people in the nation's capital, but not nearly enough to make any real difference. And one of the first laws that somebody needs to introduce is one that makes any addendum to any bill absolutely restricted to the content, quality, and intent of the primary bill being amended. This issue of amending bills with things that have nothing whatsoever to do with them, writers they call them also, has got to go. And I would certainly like to see that introduced, but who knows? Who knows if anybody will, and if they do, it'll languish in committee, no doubt, and eventually just perish.
Yeah, well spoken, Jeff, and I couldn't agree more with the statement. And I'll bet we have a lot of listeners tonight, too, who agree with your statement. That explains why they're listeners to the Jeff Rentz radio program and why they probably frequent your website to get news that is real as opposed to the regurgitated stupidity that we're getting from the billion-dollar pinstripe news people in New York City or wherever they work from. But the one thing that keeps coming back to me, I spend virtually my entire day either handling UFO information or alternatively trying to figure out what it means. I do that literally every day from wake up to lights out, trying to serve the American people in a fashion that I think is of exquisite importance. If we are being visited by intelligent creatures, I think that is worth reporting. In fact, my frank impression is that is probably the greatest scientific awakening that has ever occurred to this stage of man's development. But what worries me is the possibility that this snarl of problems that our government has either bumped into or served up to us may be being done intentionally. And that's a tall statement, and I wish to preface by emphasizing that I have no evidence along those lines. But how could more or less intelligent people have gotten us into this box canyon of crisis? As I mentioned earlier in this program, I think we would have been better off if we just turned the government over to randomly selected third graders. They wouldn't have dreamed that they could get us into a situation right. in which we find ourselves now.
Well,
and I used to work in military intelligence. I have seen the extents to which governments or military or intelligence organizations will go in order to achieve an objective and in order to achieve or build an illusion in order to help them achieve that objective. And when you take that to the highest levels, one nation against the other, you realize how possible such a scenario might be. People working inside our government, working at odds to the interests of the American people. Now, if it were just I saying this, I would even myself would question my own sensibilities, question my own sanity. But I was once posed that question by people who work at quite responsible levels of the U.S. government, elevated levels of the U.S. government. They were very interested in UFOs, and they invited me to a meeting on the East Coast. I've talked about this meeting on several of our programs in the past, and halfway through a four-hour meeting, they asked me that question. They asked me whether I had any reason to believe that there might be people inside the U.S. government working in an what they called an extra-constitutional fashion, and to the detriment of the American people. Now, these are people who work in the U.S. government who are asking that question, posing that question to some half-baked UFO investigator. That meeting took place on a Friday morning. I believe it was the 16th of May, 1997. So if they ask me that question, I feel fully comfortable in posing that question rhetorically, whether there could be some design to what has been done to the United States and a formerly free people who call uh-huh. themselves the American people.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing for newcomers to the awareness paradigm, which we're trying to promulgate here, is that that the design is quite real. And let me put something else out on the table that I haven't talked about very often, but I've mentioned it to a couple of friends in the last few days. Several years ago, a story came and went and achieved very little notice. I did publish it at Rents.com. It's important. And it gives you an idea as to how insidiously thorough these people are and how little is left to chance. They have put together, apparently assembled a string or a number of, or two or three of, the most advanced supercomputers that we are allowed to know about. On these supercomputers, as a platform, they have constructed a duplicate planet Earth. Every country, every continent, every geopolitical system, every financial system, there is a node, N-O-D-E, for every person on the planet. As they live and as they die, the computer changes and corrects. It is updated literally around the clock 25 hours a day. It is a virtual duplicate planet Earth, alive in the virtual world of computing. This is a super, super amazing achievement. And they've been working on it for years and years since it was announced that, gee, the military was going to do it for some innocuous sounding reason. Well, what they can do with this, very simply, is enter any set of parameters that they want in terms of change. Oh, change. Change we can believe in. And they'll find out plus or minus one, maybe two percentage points, exactly what's going to happen. It's the same planet. They can factor in the psychology of the peoples of each country. They can factor in the mainstream media's control on the people, the degenerating intellectual capacity of each succeeding generation, the shortening of lifespan, the increasing of cancer. It's all there. It's a total duplicate of the planet Earth. Now, when you've got that as a laboratory, you can run anything by it to see what's going to happen. And they know what's going to happen. And that's one of the tools that can be used. Interesting.
Boy, that's fascinating. I had not heard of that. It's sort of a societal spreadsheet, if you will,
sure.
where you can change parameters and look at the outcome.
Yep.
That's very interesting.
They've planned this for a long time, and they are so arrogant about it now. They mock those who would stand up, and I think that I'm left alone. I take that back. I'm still around because I serve some purpose to somebody somewhere. Like maybe they use me like a canary in a coal mine, or they watch to see what we know. There may be something to that, too. I don't know. But I know there's no other website that is quite like this one. There are a lot of websites that simply take the news and rewrite it and pretend like they're news stories. A lot of websites, it's all plagiarized. And then you've got the mainstream news. And I don't know. I don't know where. I go through so many stories every day like you do, looking for the ones that matter. And the same thing with your reports, the credible witnesses. And I know you well enough. You have very high standards, and many things that are submitted to you, you won't entertain because there are obvious flaws with them. Other researchers would probably leap and embrace them. But when you go to UFOCenter.com, you're going to get the best of the best. And I was an educator once, and I taught high school for a couple of years, and I can think of nothing better than to put in a unit on UFOs and to use Peter Davenport's National UFO Reporting Center as a teaching aid. I just can't. It would be absolutely the most popular class on campus for many. Thank you, my friend. Great to talk with you as always.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the airtime. It's been delightful to have 3 hours to talk about everything with you. You're a wonderful conversationalist and a great host, and it's a real privilege to be here, so we'll do this again sometime.
Okay, Peter, thank you very much. All right, take good care.
Good night, Jeff.
Good night. Bye. UFOCenter.com. They have an online report form there. Peter does. Make yourself familiar with it. Remember, it doesn't matter how old your report is. We're interested in it. And drop him a note and say, thanks, Peter, for 16 and a half years of incredible service to all of us. Okay, we'll be back tomorrow night. See you then.